Hi, everybody. This is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome to the Abbott Talks podcast. Over the past few years, the world has come to recognize Abbott as a company dedicated to helping people live happier and healthier lives. In this podcast series, we'll talk with the healthcare leaders, the executives, and the engineers who are working every day to develop new technologies to help people live their best lives. I know you'll enjoy this episode of the Abbott Talks podcast.
Welcome back to another episode of Abbott Talks. I'm Kayleen Brown, Managing Editor of Device Talks, and I am joined by Editorial Director Tom Salemi. Welcome to the podcast, Tom.
Thank you, Kayleen. Great to be here. That was exciting.
Yeah, it's a little nerve-wracking being on the other side. For our audience, I had three false starts. So if you thought that was good, it took some time. So thank you to our guest for his patience. But Tom, first, before we get into that, in our last episode of Abbott Talks, we unpacked Abbott's structural heart business. And now in this episode, we get an opportunity to get a look inside Abbott's heart failure business. Mm-hmm. So I just have to ask before we dig into the episode, reflecting on season three, how much have you learned?
Every episode I learn a great deal about the technology. I'm excited about today's too, because CardioMEMS is one of those medtech stories that we've all been following forever, from when it was CardioMEMS to when it became part of Abbott. But I think what we both walk away from is just a real connection with the folks that we interview with, and just a real sense of their passion and caring for the patient. I mean, honestly, I think every time we hang up, we like, darn, that was great. And we usually don't say darn. We use a worse word than that. So excited to unpack the story today.
I'm going to pause this here real quick before our keynote interview to bring you our conversation with this episode sponsor, Tecan. Hal Werenberg, Vice President, Digital Transformation for Tecan. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So Hal, I want to dig right in. Can you tell us about Tecan?
Of course. Tecan is a company that's been around for a while. We've got 40 years of experience in life science business, med tech, one of our growing areas, a lot of work with the clinical diagnostic areas. We work with most of the top 10 IVD players in the world. We also deal directly with laboratory automation, endpoint analysis, reagent creation for life sciences research. And we're really excited about our mission, about accelerating healthcare innovation globally. And it's something I've been doing with Tecan for almost 20 years now, and I'm super proud of.
So Tecan very clearly has a strong reputation for partnering with leading healthcare companies. How can you share with us how your OEM services are evolving to meet the needs of today's digital healthcare landscape?
Of course. When we think about like classic OEM structures, it was often, we're looking at the device that we're building. So a partner would come to us and it's all about the device. What are the specifications? What's it going to do? How much is it going to cost to build? What's the cost of the development project? And these are the kinds of things. It was all about building the box, building the thing. And what we're seeing with the digital healthcare landscape changes is that it's really hitting it in multiple ways, and it's moving really fast. The first one is the devices generally have an expectation of being connected, so that the company that is bringing the device to the end user has the ability to do basic monitoring, checking the functionality. Are the instruments running? Is the instrument running as much as it should be? Is the end user delighted by that instrument? Which also in turn creates a platform for the back end. So some of the mundane stuff like the automation of the billing, the automation of the logistics, whether there are consumables that need to be shipped to the end user that can be done through the monitoring platform. These are all things that also come with that. But that's just the first step. After that, we get into things like the ability to use that connection for remote service, for the remote diagnostics, so that we can make sure the instrument is running as good as it can, that the results are as high quality as possible, that the end user is getting the most out of that device at all times possible. And then taking all of that data that we have on the back end that we gather during the development phase, that we see from the real world application of it, to start using those service models, those usage models to create predictive maintenance models that are actually even potentially AI driven to understand how to make sure before the instrument actually is broken down that we can change one part in advance of those issues to reduce the total amount of service that's getting done over time, to make sure that the customer is getting the most possible usage out of it, the data quality as good as it can possibly be. A lot of people will talk about this in terms of total cost of ownership. I like to think of it as providing as much value as possible over the lifetime of the instrument. But I think that's really how the OEM manufacturing of the things has really changed. It's all about the connectivity and then all the value that you can bring with that connectivity.
Well, that's really helpful.
I'm going to pause this here really quickly, and we will hear more from this episode's sponsor, Tecan, a little later on in the podcast. But if you want to find out more now, please visit their website, partnering.tecan.com. That's partnering.tecan.com. And now we bring you the first part of our keynote interview with Dr. Finn Gustafsson, Chief Medical Officer for Abbott Heart Failure. I hope you enjoy. So then with that, our guest today actually joined Abbott in April this year. And I'm going to give a little teaser. I know you're going to go into the background, but a little teaser. It wasn't a traditional move. So our guest actually spent the past 7 years as a professor at the University of Copenhagen and then joined Abbott's heart failure business. So with that in mind, let's stop the suspense and let's bring in our guest, Dr. Finn Gustafsson, Chief Medical Officer for Abbott's heart failure business. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Kayleen and Tom, and thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. And that's why Kayleen got promoted. She does the research that I never do and knows the answers to the questions before we even ask. So I'd love to learn. I mean, whenever we have these conversations, we always want to understand the people we're talking to before we get to know the technologies. So, Finn, how did you find your way into medicine, first of all? What made you decide to be a doctor?
Yeah, that's a kind of an old story by now, Tom. I think that dates back more than 30 years. But I was really interested in physiology and how the body works. So I think that really got me into medicine. And med school, I really liked the heart, the circulatory system. I was very interested in physical training, exercise, understanding. Yeah, I mean, probably the interest has become more theoretic over the years, but at that time, you know, it was also more practical. But, you know, the physical exercise, understanding how the body works and really how the heart works. And that's how I got into cardiology and eventually heart failure.
Did you see the heart and the cardiovascular system as more of an engineering sort of marvel than a medical one?
No, I think those two go hand in hand. I think mm-hmm. you have to understand the mechanics to become a good doctor. Obviously, there are many other layers than the pure mechanical ones to being a good doctor, certainly. But you have to understand the mechanics. And I think the circulatory system is a really mechanical model in many ways. So I think they go hand in hand.
For sure. And Kayleen had mentioned your time at university. How did you move from there? And then, of course, we'd love to unpack what led you to join Abbott earlier this year.
So, essentially, you know, working with heart failure in cardiology for years drove a strong interest in research and understanding, you know, why patients' trajectories develop as they do. How can we impact them? How can we treat them? And I was for years, you could say, part of a journey where heart failure really transformed from being a disease that could be treated with digoxin and diuretics, so mm-hmm. really very limited 100-year-old pills, to suddenly being really main stage in cardiology for treatment with multiple number of drugs and an emerging, you know, a number of devices. That really spiked my research interest. And I think, you know, in the end, then combining clinical medicine with academia led me to, you know, taking the part-time, you know, the being a professor at the university while also being, you know, a consultant, obviously, in heart failure and cardiology at the Rigs Hospital in Copenhagen.
And the opportunity to join Abbott, how did that come to be and what led you to take the position?
So I've been working over the years with different device companies in the field of heart failure, in innovation, in clinical trials. And I worked with Abbott for years, both with CardioMEMS and HeartMate 3. and really enjoyed working with Abbott, I would say. I think after having spent 30 years in clinical medicine and probably last 22 or so in heart failure, you certainly will make a difference for individual patients over time, and I think I did. I think at some point I realized that there was also an opportunity to make a difference in a different way than in the traditional physician-patient encounter, one-to-one, and on the daily clinical basis, but actually maybe help drive the field of heart failure and advancement for a greater number of patients in a different role, and then this role to work with, and in particular, I would say Abbott Heart Failure, because it is the leading device company in heart failure for sure, was a very attractive one to me.
I'd like to get a better understanding of what really heart failure is. So as I said in the introduction, our last episode of Abbott Talks, we looked at structural heart. And if I know, if I was to go to my mom and say, hi, that's a really great interview on structural heart, and my next interview is on heart failure, she's going to say, what's the difference? So for myself and those who aren't in the know, can you first explain what heart failure is? And is it just the failure of the structural of the heart, or is it more than that? And how does heart failure impact the heart's ability to function?
Right. So heart failure is, first of all, a very common disease, right? We estimate that around 7 million people in the United States suffer from heart failure. It's the most common cause for hospital admission. And essentially, all the heart diseases we know, that they could be structural, they could be heart attacks, they could be arrhythmias, they could be, you know, all the things we talk about in cardiology can ultimately all lead to heart failure. So that's kind of the end station for all of these diseases. So it is in the end when the heart is not able to pump sufficient amount of blood to the organs, either at rest or when we exercise or stress the circulatory system, or can only do so at the expense of increased pressures inside the heart. And actually the latter really relates to one of the Abbott devices that we're talking about, namely CardioMEMS, the pressure sensor, because it really, that's the underlying physiology. So it is when the heart, for some reason, with multiple, the typical ones being high blood pressure or heart attacks, diabetes, so typically also lifestyle diseases, lead to the failure of the pump to really pump blood to the organs and the muscles, either at rest or when we exercise.
Spoken like an experienced professor. So I understand better than I have in a long time, so I really appreciate that. Let's talk about the patients who are most commonly affected by heart failure. I know you touched on it a little bit, but are there specific risk factors or conditions that might make them more likely to require intervention?
Yeah, so when patients develop heart failure, heart failure is a chronic disease that evolves over time. And there are like different stages, you could say, like early heart failure. You can be at risk for heart failure, and some of those we mentioned already, prior heart attack, diabetes, obesity, high blood pressure, being some of them. Certainly also genetic diseases, so heart failure can run in families. You can get heart failure from, you know, when you're only a few months old, if you have some of these inherited diseases, and then of course until the end of life. So it is a spectrum, but when heart failure progresses, we typically start treating with drugs, and we have effective drugs nowadays that can treat many patients and actually give them an acceptable quality of life and also a much better prognosis than previously. But as heart failure progresses, that's typically when we start thinking about different devices that can help with the long-term survival and also improve symptoms. Symptoms are typically tiredness and shortness of breath, and the tendency to accumulate fluid, typically swollen legs, swollen belly, and patients typically show up that way at the initial time of diagnosis.
I wonder what the first symptoms were. Is there a percentage, like where it's considered heart failure? Like, is it not failure at 85% of efficiency, but under 85, it is failure? Is there a number, or is it more just a general diagnosis?
Yeah, that's a good question. And actually, it is a continuum. So there is no percentage. And also, it is a combination of how the body, you know, the body composition. If you're a very small person, you'll need a less heart function. If you're a very big, you know, 200-pound fellow, your heart is going to need to be larger and pump stronger to meet the demands. So it is really when we see those compensatory mechanisms, as we call them, so the mechanisms where the heart starts, you know, the body starts to try to alleviate some of the consequences of the impaired heart function, if you will. Mm-hmm. Typically, activation of hormones and other stuff that actually drag water back into the body. So that those are some of the consequences as the way we see the fluid build up in the patients.
So from what I'm understanding, and I'm going to use these very general terms, so please feel free to correct me, but the sickest of patients require device intervention, which I feel like brings us beautifully over to Abbott's heart failure portfolio. So we'll deep dive into each of the products a little later on, but just for context, can you give us just an overview of Abbott's heart failure portfolio?
Yeah, so the Abbott Heart Failure Division has right now three main products that that we serve heart failure patients with. We have what we call a Centromap, which is a pump that is used acutely for circulatory support in the hospital, in critically ill patients, even patients who are suffering a cardiac arrest, but basically what we call patients in cardiogenic shock. So this is a temporary pump external to the body that can provide circulatory support and even also oxygenate the blood, so supply the blood with oxygen to sustain life for a limited period of time while either the patient recovers or receives a heart transplant or receives one of the other products in the portfolio, namely the durable left ventricular assist device called HeartMate 3. That's a pump that is surgically implanted into the patient with the driveline comes through the skin, driven by external batteries that the patient can go home with and live with for years, more than a decade, unless a transplantation is performed or is needed. So those are the two circulatory support products. And the last product we use is in earlier stages of heart failure, not the very earliest stages, but typically patients who remain symptomatic despite the drug therapy, and that's the CardioMEMS. Mm-hmm. And that's a small sensor that is implanted under local anesthesia through the a vein, a blood vessel, typically in the groin or in the neck. It's about the size of a quarter or so, or actually smaller, but the size of a dime. Sorry, still getting used to the U.S. currency. We don't use coins much anymore, but it's small, and it's implanted in the lung artery through a catheter left there. And without a battery, is able to transmit the pressures from the vessel, which reflects, as we spoke about before, the pressures inside the heart, which are really critical. So when the pressures go up, this is a marker that fluid is starting to build up or will build up in a few days if you don't do something. And that gives us an opportunity to intervene early, prior to the patient feeling it, prior to anything happening, and with medications, and then prevent, you know, fluid buildup, decompensation, and the need for going to the hospital. So this is a monitoring device. So those are the products in the portfolio.
I think we get very excited when we hear the word sensors and data, and they're certainly the buzzwords. And as I mentioned earlier, CardioMEMS, I think, was one of the first to really bring this not only to light at MedTech, but also particularly within the heart. How is the data sent to the doctor? How is a physician able to say, "Whoa, your condition's getting slightly worse. You need to come in and see me." What is that process like? What is the device the doctor's looking at? How does that entire process work?
Essentially, the patient is implanted in the hospital, goes home same day typically, and brings home a pillow.
Okay.
And it's not the most, you know, it doesn't look a lot like a pillow, but that's the best name right now. And that's connected through a secure connection to the internet and will transmit. The patient lies down on the pillow for about 18 seconds every morning.
Oh, okay.
Press a button, and then these pressure measurements go directly to a secure connection to a system that the physician or the nurse at the hospital will access a couple of times a week, three times a week, or alarms are sent if pressures are really high. And then that, you know, allows the physician or the nurse to check the pressures, contact the patient if need be, or say everything is fine. And that really is the way that that this communication works.
I've heard about the pillow, and I've kind of always tried to figure out, well, I put my head on the pillow, not my chest. I wondered how that works. So this clears up so much for me. It's like I now understand the process. And I understand also that it's becoming more mainstream. We're not the only ones recognize the value of data and sensors. I know CMS had a positive expansion of coverage earlier this year. How is the adoption for patients growing? How widely accepted are the CardioMEMS sort of procedure becoming? Is it becoming available to more patients? And how is it finding its way into patients and into clinical decisions?
It is increasing, obviously, with the NCD being going through. That is an important milestone for more patients getting access to this therapy or monitoring device. It's still only a few percent of heart failure patients that are being monitored with CardioMEMS. So there is a lot of patients that are still not, you know, being offered or treated with the device. It's not for every patient. I mean, some patients do really well and have, you know, no symptoms on drug therapy, and they probably don't need this device, at least not to the extent of our current knowledge, maybe in the future when we get more trials. Right now, it's patients that remain symptomatic despite drug therapy or medications, appropriate medications. And for those, we're still seeing a moderate uptake. And I think there is a lack of knowledge. There is probably a little bit of a lack of tradition to use devices unless you're desperately sick in the hospital. In heart failure in particular.
On behalf of patients or physicians, is it the physicians who don't see the need for it, or the patients who don't want to go into the procedure, maybe a combination of both?
Yeah, I think that there's a combination of both. And I think part of this is to do with, knowledge dissemination, understanding. And we know that for medical devices, there is a slow adoption in cardiology in general. There's a long lag time between devices being recognized as effective and useful for patients and the actual uptake. And so I think there's work to be done there. What we see is that patients benefit from this, not just by what we've shown in trials, that the risk of having to be admitted to a hospital with fluid overload is dramatically reduced. In subgroups, we also see improved survival with the device because you manage them better. And finally, and actually an interesting study just came out documenting that. I've been working with the CardioMEMS and implanted CardioMEMS for years before I joined Abbott, and I've definitely seen this with patients. But the sense of security, the sense that people know that somebody's watching them, right?
Yeah.
We have patients telling them, we didn't go on vacation, we didn't go anywhere because I was always uncertain what was going to happen. Now with this monitoring device, I know I'm going to be fine, you know, because otherwise they will tell me. And actually led to, I would say, you know, really fulfilling one of the visions for Abbott in general, really empowering patients and letting them live their lives. So I see that as an added benefit beyond the hard endpoints, if you will. And interestingly, a study just came out documenting them as a substudy to more or less trials where patients really voiced that. So I think that's, so I think to your question, it's only about 1 to 2% right now that are being monitored with this device. And there is certainly, it's not 100% should not be monitored, but there's certainly, and we'll see, I'm sure, a greater uptake in the coming years.
That's great. No, I mean, we joked about data before. I was speaking as a reporter or as a journalist, but as a patient, I love having data. I mean, I love knowing what's, because you don't know when you're going to see your physician again. Honestly, I mean, obviously, if you're in a critical state, unfortunately, you will. But in those in-between states where you're kind of like, do I feel this way? Do I feel that way? You try to call it. It's just, it seems like this technology is coming in at just the right time. So excited to hear that adoption is ticking up, albeit a little slowly, but I'm sure you'll take care of that.
We're going to take a quick break from our keynote interview to bring you the conclusion of our conversation with this episode's sponsor, Tecan.
But what about the devices themselves? I mean, are they being changed due to today's healthcare landscape?
Yeah, I think, you know, we're seeing a lot of movement in how can AI change diagnostic practices in general, whether that's personalized medicine, oncology, patient monitoring. These devices themselves are actually changing what their function is and how they do their work. And whether our devices that we're building are preparing samples to flow into the type of endpoint analysis that are feeding those insights generated by AI, or actually the analysis device themselves. So these devices are infused with the cutting edge of technology, which is really exciting because that's basically the manifestation of our mission statement, which is to scale healthcare innovation globally. And it's been really exciting to help our OEM customers who are taking these devices out into the world to do exactly that, to have an impact across the globe.
So it's always clear to me that Tecan has a value-forward strategy, which leads me to wonder, how does Tecan support its partners in navigating the complex regulatory landscape, particularly when bringing new digital health solutions to market?
I mean, first and foremost, I have to give a shout out to our quality and regulatory teams. They are absolutely phenomenal. They are one of the strengths of the organization. And I think it's exactly that strong team, which is kind of at the core of our ethos, core of our identity. And we bring that to really everything we do. But as far as what does it mean for an individual partner or customer that's working with us, we have a broad experience. So we work with most of the top 10 IVD companies that are out there. We work with huge pharma companies, we work in regulated spaces, and we do that across the world. And we have a organization that gets audited quite frequently because of these products that we make and these services that we offer. And it means that this experience we gather, we internalize in terms of best practices, we internalize it in our standard operating procedure, in our product development, but it's also something that we can gift to our customers. Because we work with so many customers, we actually have more experience in a wider range of topics and regulated environments than any single customer can. And so when you work with a partner like us, it means that you actually get that brought to you. And so even, you know, startups love it because we can kind of bring that expertise to them, whether it's a contract manufacturing thing and it's their first device coming to market and they need a lot of advice. But even large organizations navigating new spaces, the first time developing a new type of device or wondering how the European AI regulations might impact the product strategy that they're developing, these are all things that we bring an informed opinion on, and it comes from our experience and our expertise.
Well, Hal, I've had so much fun with you today. Hal Wehrenberg, Vice President, Digital Transformation of Tecan, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
Once again, a huge thank you to this episode's sponsor, Tecan, for allowing us the opportunity to share this conversation with our audience. To learn more about Tecan, please visit their website at partnering.tecan.com, partnering.tecan.com. And now we bring you the conclusion of our conversation with Dr. Finn Gustafsson, Chief Medical Officer for Abbott Heart Failure. I think the other side of adoption is adherence. So I'd be interested to know about patients' adherence. Are they using CardioMEMS the way they're supposed to? Are you seeing the patient responsibility actually come to fruition in the way you need it to?
Yeah, so I think generally, yes, patients are compliant and motivated to use it. And I think there's a selection process as well, right? You want to talk to patients prior to implanting a device in them that they are interested in using it. Otherwise, it doesn't do anything on itself, if you will. So it's a really important point, an important point to discuss with the patient prior to, having this, making the decision of to implant.
Excellent. Perfect. So this is a good time for us to, I think, shift over to HeartMate 3. How has HeartMate 3 changed the way clinicians think about using LVADs to treat advanced heart failure? So let's maybe start there.
Well, so LVADs have had a long history back from when devices were large and bulky with a short lifespan, and then transitioning into what we call the current continuous flow devices, and now with the HeartMate 3 introduced in 2015. We really see that the technological evolution has transitioned LVADs, left ventricular assist devices, these implantable pumps, from being something we would use for a short time just prior to a transplant when really needing a plan for transplantation, to devices that really treat advanced heart failure, irrespective of whether it's for short term for cardiac heart transplantation or as what we call destination therapy, as the final therapy for heart failure ongoing. And that transition happened probably with the second generation pump called HeartMate 2, but really took on after the MOMENTUM 3 trial, which compared HeartMate 3 to HeartMate 2 and showing a much improved outcomes with the current HeartMate 3, in particular with respect to risk of some of the complications that were prevalent with earlier or legacy pumps.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about the MOMENTUM 3 study. So you gave a very high level of the results that you saw, but could you dig in a little bit more and like what did you glean from it? How does it speak to HeartMate 3 and so on?
Yeah, so HeartMate 3, so the MOMENTUM 3 trial compared the HeartMate 3, the current pump in use, with the HeartMate 2, which was in itself a tremendous step forward compared to the old pulsatile pumps. And the study was a randomized trial in patients with advanced heart failure, and it's the largest study ever done in advanced heart failure and in mechanical circulatory support. The study showed after 2 years, similar survival, but a much lower rate of stroke, thrombosis, so clots inside the pump, which was a problem previously because then you have to exchange the pump. You have to open the patient's chest again, put in a new pump, which is not necessarily a benign thing. But so those endpoints were massively reduced with the HeartMate 3. After 5 years, actually, recently, a 5-year follow-up was done, and at that time, there was a difference in survival with the two devices as well in favor of HeartMate 3. And actually, for the first time, we were able to see a median survival exceeding 5 years. So
Wow.
essentially, so with the HeartMate 3, so essentially, survival with this pump is on average more than 5 years, and as I mentioned, we have patients on these pumps for 10 years or more. The data from MOMENTUM 3 was corroborated by not just being trial data, patients selected for a trial, but also real-world data from what we call the INTERMACS registry in the U.S., so a much larger cohort, finding completely similar, actually 60% 5-year survival. And a European registry as well of more than 400 patients, completely similar survival. So very robust data showing us that in these very, very sick patients who are prone to die within days to weeks if they're not treated with mechanical circulatory support, we're now extending lives well beyond 5 years in these patients. So from that perspective, MOMENTUM 3 was really really changed the landscape and the perception of durable mechanical circulatory support in the field.
I love that so much. You flagged my interest when you were talking about real-world evidence and registry. So I'm going to circle back to that. But before we do that, I have to think about the patient experience. So what impact, and it could be anecdotal, but what impact has HeartMate 3 had on patients, like their longer lifespan or a better quality of life? Like, what have you seen?
So first of all, obviously, for many of these patients, the initial goal is to survive, because for most of these patients, the alternative is essentially death within a very short time frame. So that's typically the initial focus. I think typically once you then survive, then you want quality of life and you know, being able to do all the things, which makes complete sense, fortunately. And that's where we've seen, you know, a huge progress. Very large improvements in quality of life for these patients, both compared to prior to the pump implant in patients, but also compared to earlier pump products. So better quality of life, 80% have minimal or no heart failure symptoms after treatment with the pump. A few still have some heart failure symptoms, but 80% are what we call class 1 or 2 symptoms. There is a tripling of the 6-minute walk distance with the pump.
Wow.
And very significant improvements in quality of life. So is everything perfect? No, not necessarily. I mean, you have to live with a pump. You have a driveline. You have batteries that you exchange every 16 hours or so, which is a small process. But of course, if you travel or if you go out, you need to bring extra batteries. So you can't go swimming, but you can shower. So there are some limitations. But overall, we see that the quality of life is high, and we certainly see that patients, even when presented with the option of being transplanted, getting rid of the driveline, if you will, and the batteries, we see patients that actually prefer to stay on the VAT because
really?
They know it's durable and they don't need to take drugs to suppress the immune system. So I'm not saying that all patients would choose to stay on the VAT, certainly not, but just as an example of the tremendous improvement in quality of life we've seen with the HeartMate 3 compared to especially to earlier pumps. And it is transformative.
Absolutely. Now, I promise to circle back to real-world evidence and registries. So what role do they play in validating and expanding the use of Abbott's heart failure technologies?
I think this is general to cardiovascular medicine, medicine in general, that we typically test our drugs or devices in a selected population, right? Where we think that it needs to be safe to test it in that population, needs to be meaningful, and we need to be able to measure outcomes. So we do that in selected group, and that's helpful. It helps us, informs us, you know, whether the device is safe and effective, and we saw that with the Momentum 3 trial. The challenge is, of course, that selection process also creates a boundary for we can to extrapolate to say, hey, can we use this result and talk about everybody else? What about that patient who might not have fitted exactly the inclusion criteria for the pivotal trial? And that's why the real world evidence becomes, you know, crucial to extend the knowledge from the randomized clinical trial to the broader population. See, can you reproduce the findings that you saw in the clinical trial? Are there signals that we need to be aware of in the general population who typically have more comorbidities, have different profiles, maybe different age spans, et cetera? And that's where it's been so, I would almost say surprisingly fantastic to see how the Intermax registry and the European registry mirror the Momentum 3 trial results. Very, very, very narrowly.
One last thought about HeartMate 3, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention there's been some news around aspirin use with HeartMate 3. So what's changing there, and what could that mean for patients?
Yeah, that's kind of the next chapter when we talk about mechanical circulatory support, because we have clearly had tremendous technological development, and that is continuing and more to come. But we're also seeing that with the improvements we've seen, with a 1 year survival of almost 90%, driving up survival just, you know, short term is probably not, is not going to be the goal for the next generations and for the total management package. So it's also about how do we treat these patients, because they're not just surviving 5-6 months. This is long-term therapy, 10 years, if you will. So how do we manage these patients? And one of the management pieces of having a HeartMate 3 is that you need to inhibit the coagulation system to avoid getting clots in the system. That's like with mechanical heart valves and others. If you put things into the circulatory system, you need to anticoagulate. And historically, this was done with warfarin and aspirin together. And we knew that bleeding, because of these needed treatments, was a significant risk for these patients. So typically bleeding from the nose or bleeding from the stomach, and which needed then attention and was a cause of morbidity in these patients. And HeartMate 3 had very significant technological advances compared to earlier pumps, in that it was much more compatible with the bloodstream. And that led to the hypothesis that maybe aspirin is not necessary. So that's why we did a trial called the ARIES trial, where we randomized more than 500 patients with just implanted with a HeartMate 3 to either receive standard therapy with warfarin, so Coumadin, the classical anticoagulation drug, and aspirin, to randomize them to receive either that or Coumadin or warfarin plus placebo, so no aspirin. Okay. And the hypothesis was that you wouldn't need it, that it would be just as good not to do it. And we showed that very, very convincingly. But furthermore, we showed a 40% reduction in bleeding events if you did not use aspirin, if you got placebo, really leading to also associated very, very large decrease in hospitalization need in patients. So really was now is part of the label that you only need warfarin when you get a HeartMate 3. And that's, I think it's an example of how we are moving this field forward, not just by, you know, improving the devices per se, but actually the entire patient treatment.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. Just a flat final question, sort of building off of that answer. And we open this up by you're giving us a great sense of the large problem of heart failure. You're seeing progress in CardioMEMS use in it helping patients who are less sick. The LVAD information was startling. I never knew someone would choose to remain on the pump if an organ was available. And I know it's not everybody, but still the fact that someone does that, I think, speaks to what the pumps are able to do. Where do we go from here? You've outlined the size of the problem. You've showed us some signs of progress, but what excites you about the future?
Well, I think there's more work to be done on the this whole actually also doing very robust science around mechanical circulatory support, like the ARIES trial, and we've just published another, I think, very important study called the ASPIRE study, which informed us that using chlorhexidine silver dressings for the exit site for the driveline was associated with a almost 40% reduction in driveline infection, which is one of the remaining issues that we unfortunately have with having the driveline. But actually doing trials, doing real robust science, I like to call it LVAD science 2.0, because we're really moving away from just registries, but doing real trials in the field, also showing that the field is maturing. That's going to, I think, really improve outcomes when we focus on the entire patient journey, not just the device per se. But obviously, the future will also definitely include improvements of devices, the smaller devices that will deliver the same pump energy, if you will, and also at some point technologies that will allow us to have not permanent time with a driveline going through the skin. So I see we're going there. Everybody recognizes that that's going to take some more time, but we're working on, I think, importantly, the entire management and treatment of these patients, not just isolated to the technology per se, but the whole treatment package. And I think that's going to really transform outcomes for patients.
Remarkable. Well, I think this is one of the true medtech stories where you're building devices and tools that are keeping people alive and giving them a way to live a life as well at the same time. So remarkable stuff. Great conversation, Finn. I'm glad you've joined us in the medtech industry. It's great to have your expertise and your knowledge here. And we're really grateful you chose to share it here on the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, well, that's a wrap, Kayleen Brown. It's time to play our favorite game. What did you learn? What did you learn from our conversation today with Finn Gustafson?
Well, I definitely learned a lot. I think at the beginning, I had posed a question to you, you know, reflecting on season 3. How much did you learn? I didn't actually think that I'd also be answering that question at the end of the interview. I learned a ton. So thank you so much, Finn. But one of the standouts out of the many standouts was the fact that some patients, not all patients, but some patients, when they're given the opportunity to have a transplant instead of keep their LVAD, they're choosing to keep the LVAD. And you
that
don't
blew
really
my mind.
Right? Yep. Like we both had this, like we both said, wow, and sat back and I saw our own reaction because you don't think about that. And I think it makes such a strong case for how impactful these devices really are on the patient experience. And Finn had mentioned that for those patients who are choosing to keep the LVAD, it's because they know the device is reliable. They already know how the quality of their life is working for them. And to risk that, and I'm using the word risk, not Abbott, not Finn. The patient, they're choosing not to risk the quality of life that they've gotten used to. Again, understanding the reliability of the device is a really good fit for them. It just is such a mark for how far we've come with LVADs. It's pretty cool. What about you? What did you learn, Tom?
Well, I, as I said during the interview, I never knew what the pillow actually was with the CardioMEMS. I always had this image of, why would someone lie in a pillow? How long do they have to lie in this pillow? Is it a pillow they sleep in like for the whole night and you're uploading data like the whole night? I'm glad we got some clarity on that. I'm sorry the medtech world sees how dumb I am when it comes to some medical devices.
How dumb we are.
Thank you for taking the bullet with me. Like, oh, pillow. I imagine it's a pillow, but there's many different kinds of pillows. So I'm glad Finn enabled me to see the light on that. But just, I think also more broadly, just the problem that heart failure is, the progress that Abbott is making, and the hope for the future. I think they'll get a lot of other great products they're working on. So be exciting to track the space. So I learned medtech is cool, but I knew that. So I don't know if I actually learned it.
Reinforced might be a better way of saying it. It's been reinforced that medtech is really cool. And we are very, very lucky to be part of this industry in our very dumb, small way. I want to emphasize it again. We are so dumb, but we are so lucky to learn from those who are much smarter than us.
Exactly. And we're also very lucky to have the fine folks at TCAN sponsor this episode of Abbott Talks. They are great supporters of Device Talks. We're very grateful, and you should go to tcan.com for more information. That's TECAN.com for more information. All right, Kayleen Brown, if folks have just discovered this podcast and the Device Talks podcast world, what should they do if they don't want to miss a future episode?
My best recommendation would be to follow the Device Talks Podcast Network on their favorite podcast player. And if you're going to ask me, my favorite podcast player is all of them that play Device Talks. With the Device Talks Podcast Network, you're going to get access to every single one of our podcast episodes. But if you want to follow Abbott Talks, pure and simple Abbott Talks, you can do that as well. Abbott Talks, one word, on all of your favorite players. And we hope that you do, because we love to provide these great medtech stories.
Absolutely. And we also hope you'll connect with us on LinkedIn. We love being part of your medtech conversations. Tom Salemi, editorial director of Device Talks.
Kayleen Brown, managing editor for Device Talks. But please do, really, please follow us. Please send us messages. That really gives us the fire to continue to have these conversations and find our way through our email and all of the other parts of our job that is not as fulfilling as sitting down with people smarter than us. So please message us. Please give us those fires. And thank you so much to Abbott. Thank you, Finn. And thank you, Tekin, for allowing us to do, well, my dream job. So thank you.
Can't say anymore. Thanks, everybody, for joining us.